Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear. Vanity Fair.
So, Dan, Donald Trump's been reportedly dozing off during the first stage of his trial. Have you been staying wide awake for us there?
I will say jury selection is not necessarily the most thrilling thing in the world. But we're trying the best we can from an overflow room to ascertain this guy's behaviors. So maybe there's some eyes closing. Maybe there's a jaw going slack. But, you know, in his defense, perhaps it could be understandable. But it is genuinely unprecedented. It is genuinely a historic event. And people are trying to glean what they can.
That's Dan Adler, who is covering Trump's hush money cover-up trial for Vanity Fair. And I'm Brian Stelter. Let me welcome you to Inside the Hive. This week, we are multitasking. In a few minutes, we're going to talk with Dave Cullen, the author of the seminal book Columbine, on the occasion of a very somber anniversary. But first, we're going inside the Manhattan Criminal Courthouse. That's where Dan and lots of other reporters have been watching Trump try to stay awake. So, Dan, Monday and Tuesday were consumed by jury selection. Maybe Trump wasn't the only person that was bored. Tell us your vantage point. How are you able to watch this from the overflow room? How does it work down there?
So, as you'd expect, this is a very highly scrutinized, covered trial. And because the actual courtroom where Trump is sitting is mostly filled with prospective jurors at the moment, there are only six pool reporters in that room at a given time. And the rest of us, myself included, are sitting in an overflow room where we have a little TV screen that shows you Trump and his lawyers and the prosecutors. So in some sense, you know, we have a better view of Trump's face than the people in the actual courtroom because they're sitting in the back, I believe, and behind all these jurors. But still, all of us are doing our best with the limited amount that has happened so far to kind of like take the temperature of this guy and the people around him.
So that means there are cameras in the courtroom. You know, public broadcasts, live feeds of the courtroom are not permitted during this trial due to a state rule. But because of this overflow situation and the obligation to provide access for the press, there is at least one camera, right? It's pointed at Trump and you're able to see him.
Yeah, there are cameras that play for people who are already in the courthouse. So it's sort of like, a private video feed.
So where do you come down on this whole sleep debate? You know, I know it's a distraction. I get it, but we're not at opening statements yet. So just indulge me for a moment. Do you think he's just bored? Do you think he's fallen asleep for a minute? Do you think he's just, what do you think's going on?
Yeah, I mean, it is a distraction. I will say it's, court is theater. And some of this stuff is funny and interesting. And, if you put it in the context of his use of insults related to people's energy levels and sleepiness, it might be fair game. I can't really tell, to be honest with you. Again, we're looking at this little video screen. There are reporters in the courtroom who have observed him falling asleep. I have no reason to doubt that. We're a pretty dry, stuffy courtroom. It's a long day. So if he dozed off for a second or two, I wouldn't necessarily be shocked.
The hosts over on MSNBC are having so much fun with this. Here's Chris Hayes referring, as you said, to Trump's tendency to use insult nicknames like Sleepy Joe for President Biden. Here's what Hayes said about Trump.
I mean, I do feel like if you call your opponent Sleepy Joe, you have one job. Stay for the awake. Rest of the campaign, yeah. Which is like you got to like clockwork orange those puppies, like open at all times.
Of course, Trump says he was praying when he closed his eyes, that from a man not known for his religiosity. But Dan, let's talk about the jurors. What have you seen? What have you observed so far as New Yorkers either try to get on this jury or more often try to stay off this jury?
It's been really interesting. Again, jury selection is not the most thrilling thing in the world on its own terms, but watching average everyday people be asked about their opinions of the former president of the United States and having him sit there and listen to them and trying to watch him react has been really fascinating. And people have, you know, like insights. You know, there's one person who was chosen as a juror who said, "I find this guy really fascinating and mysterious. When he walks into the room, everyone reacts one way or another." And then there were other people who said, "You know, I'm not particularly political, but you know, I have friends who feel offended by this thing he said or that thing he said." And watching Trump as he reacts to these things, and you know, as a lot of people have pointed out, he seems to have reacted the most when people mention a familiarity with his books or The Apprentice. You know, I think he laughed maybe just once. It is sort of like a window into, I think, a lot of what we'll be seeing throughout the course of the trial, which is just the spectacle of seeing this guy sitting in one place in a pretty unglamorous courtroom, having to sit still and listen to people talk about him.
Right. My wife, Jamie, was on New York One this morning talking about this, and she said, look, this is the system working. You know, Trump's going to rant and rave and complain about the system and claim it's rigged and broken and corrupt and all Biden's fault, but it's actually working. You know, we're finding a jury of his peers. And as of midweek, 7 jurors have been seated. Remind us, Dan, how many are needed in total, including alternates, before this can actually get started?
We need a jury of 12 and then 6 alternates. So we have 7 out of 18 at the moment. And Tuesday went pretty quickly. There were some jurors being selected in a manner that went faster than it did on Monday. So it's hard to predict these things. You don't know who will be in the next pool of prospective jurors, but things do seem to be moving along.
Yeah, the judges indicated that we could hear opening statements on Monday. If not Monday, it'll certainly be soon thereafter. Have you heard much about what to anticipate when that moment comes? I mean, for all the hoopla associated with this Monday, it's really going to be opening statements that are going to be the main event.
Yeah, you know, there's been so much build up to this trial for so many reasons. It's the first criminal trial of a former president, and opening statements will be the moment where people on both sides have a chance to crystallize what this means, both in a big picture sense, but also, you know, what we'll actually be watching for the next number of weeks or potentially even months.
Yeah, I also wonder if the Trump side, the Trump fan base, will be more animated. You know, one of the takeaways on Monday was that, you know, it wasn't really like a big turnout. There weren't a lot of Trump supporters outside the courtroom the way some people imagined. I can't help but link this to the performance of his stock. DJT, that stock for Truth Social has been plummeting, has been failing. It's not as if there are millions of Trump supporters rushing out to buy shares or, you know, to rush out to support him in person. Maybe that changes over the course of this trial, but I don't think so. I think it's telling, Dan, that there's more journalists downtown at the courthouse than there are Trump supporters.
That's definitely the case. It's definitely more of a news crew thing than it is a political activist protester thing. And the people who are there, it's kind of like third string. You know, it's Andrew Giuliani. It's Laura Loomer. It's not like, you know, the A-team.
Right. There was a really interesting moment where Trump could be overheard. What was he doing? He was kind of like loudly sighing or griping at one moment, and the judge had to interrupt and say, I will arrest you. I will intervene if you try to intimidate a juror.
Yeah, this is something hard for me to see from the overflow room, but from what I understand, he was sort of muttering in the direction of a juror, and the judge took that to be some sort of intimidation tactic.
I can't imagine that that's the last of that, given everything that Trump is posting on Truth Social, given how much he's complained about the restrictions. Remind us, the prosecutors want more restrictions. They want Trump sanctioned for his misconduct.
Yeah, they want $1,000 fines, which you know, is obviously in this context not the hugest amount of money, but there's some symbolic value, I think. And also, you know, it's just sort of funny, like you know, it's like a kid in a class who can't keep his mouth shut, and you know, you got to put a quarter in the piggy bank, that kind of thing.
Put a quarter in the swear jar.
Yeah.
Or many quarters. But you're right. That is the That's the tension of this story thus far. Donald Trump, a man whose voice has been so loud, who has been overwhelming in our political discourse for the better part of a decade, a man who cannot be silenced. And yet in this moment, he has been. He has to sit there and take it.
Yeah, there's it has been, frankly, quite boring so far. There's something heartening about that. You know, what you said, that this is the system working, that this is, you know, no matter what position of power you've occupied in the world, you at some point might have to do the same boring thing that anyone else has to do.
It actually kind of makes me want to be on a jury someday.
I think it's surreal for all of us as reporters to watch this happen. I think it must be even more surreal for the jurors.
Oof, so true. Dan, thanks so much. We will check in with you as the trial progresses.
Thanks, Brian.
Let me fit in a quick break here. When we come back on Inside the Hive, a conversation about Columbine 25 years later with author Dave Cullen.
Three, two, one. Political Breakdown is a daily politics podcast from KQED in San Francisco that goes deep into the issues you care about. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Look, 2024 is gonna get weird.
Who decides when there's been an insurrection or not?
We're still in the innovation phase of AI.
And that is where you see that they're not actually being equitable and trying to build a utopia where we can all use drugs happily together.
But whatever happens this election year, the KQED politics team is in this with you. Political Breakdown. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. I'm Brian Stelter.
And Jay Burkett begins our coverage. He is live in Littleton, Colorado.
It's hard to believe that this week marks 25 years since the massacre at Columbine High School.
A total of 15 people are believed to have died here, 12 students, one faculty member, and the two young killers. Investigators say this attack appears to have been carefully planned for a long time.
My next guest, Dave Cullen, is the author of the definitive book on the tragedy and the aftermath. It is simply titled Columbine. Dave, thanks for coming on.
Sure. I only talk to you on horrible days usually, sadly.
Right you are. Yes, we've done this several times on CNN, and that's actually where I wanted to start. I know I have my own answers to this question, but I'd like to hear yours. Why is it important to take note of these anniversaries?
Well, I think the anniversaries are a good time to just stop and take stock, because normally we're always, you know, covering the latest shooting or, you know, this or, and we're seeing things in isolation. And, you know, 10 years out, 20 years out, especially 25 years out, it's really good to step back and see, like, okay, what has this wrought? You know, what's the big picture of what's happening here and what's, you know, still needs to be done?
Take us back to where you were and what you were doing when the gunfire rang out.
Well, I lived in Denver, and I was just sitting down to lunch. I remember so clearly it was a budget gourmet frozen TV dinner, beef stroganoff, and just sat down to the local news, and it was just hitting local news at about 11:40-ish. And they didn't think it, you know, was necessarily that much. There were sounds of gunfire, no reports of anyone injured. And so I was back and forth. Oh, is this something? And I decided I just need to get in my car and go. Oh, I left a voicemail to my editor at Salon and said, oh, this is probably nothing, but in case it develops into something, I'll be out there. And I just drove out there, you know, hoping to find something. And outside of my left side window, I saw to the south helicopters circling, like a half dozen of them, which is probably all the news choppers in Denver, right, at that time. And so that's when my stomach sank and I knew, oh my God, something horrible is happening over there. And it, you know, it really looked like vultures circling too. And I just drove toward them. I took an exit sort of try to line them up and drove toward the helicopters until I hit the police barricade and pulled into a mini mall, and you go further on foot. And I said, which way is Columbine High? He said, that way. And I ran that way.
Did you feel like another one of the vultures?
I didn't think of them as vultures, like as a judgment, more just like that was the visceral thing.
Like you an know, actual visual. Like, yes. You saw literally circling. And the helicopters were important for the following reason. The live television news pictures showed that this was an absolute catastrophe. You could see kids trying to escape. You could see police dragging a dead body, trying to save lives. The television news pictures across cable and across broadcast showed us this was a massacre.
Yeah, and there were 1,000 first responders. So even those overhead shots is just, I mean, it's like an army, right? Descending on Littleton, coming from all over the Denver metro area. So yeah, it's just the immediate visual looks like, you know, all hell is broken out in the suburb of Denver.
Right. It looked like a war zone. And I remember as I was a freshman in high school, my parents tried to shield me from it. They did not want us watching. They did not want me and my brothers seeing this because Columbine was obviously for my generation, a turning point psychologically about school safety. But I do think we should step back and point out this was not the first high profile school shooting in the U.S. It was a turning point for reasons we can get into. But give us the context back in the 1990s for when this is happening.
Sure. And that's why it was so important, because it wasn't the first. You know, Oklahoma City happened 2 or 3 years before. That was the most horrible ever. Worst terrorist attack in the U.S. history. And it seemed like such an aberration, a one-off. So we didn't feel like it's this pattern of something. Nobody in America felt like oh, we're next, right? With Columbine, because there had been like 4 or 5, I hate to say smaller ones, but you, God, I hate
that's
saying
that's only, but that's accurate. You're right, Dave. I'm thinking about Paducah, for example. I remember Paducah, exactly. 1997, 3 students killed, 5 injured. And at the time, that was a horrifying national tragedy.
Yeah, there was Paducah, I guess it was 3. Most of them were 1 or 2. And after each one, there was kind of a panic in the country. I remember so many op-eds. It became a big story that, like, now there are 2 of these. Now there are 3. And in suburban and small towns, like, parents across America were getting more and more scared. And then when Columbine blew the roof off of it, and we thought it was a hostage negotiation that went on for 4.5 hours. So within an hour, all the networks stopped the soaps, the daytime soaps, which was a huge thing for them because that was their cash cow. It knocked a war off of television. CNN was 24/7 on our massive bombing of Belgrade for Kosovo. That was a war, the story dominating everything, instantly knocked the war off. So this was just monstrous proportions. And that was the moment then, like, oh my God, this is not just happening, it's going to happen, but it's massive. And every parent in America felt terrified to send their kids to school. And, you know, for the next 25 years till now, parents are still, after these things, afraid to, like, am I sending my kid off to die? And kids, too, they're pretty pissed off. That's why Parkland blew off, because, you know, David Hogg and the others said, like, you have been sending us to die. This has been going on 19 years before we were born, and you've done nothing. You just march us off to die. Most of us aren't going to die, but some of us are. And you're okay with that, adult America?
Well, that's why I wanted to have this conversation this week. We were talking at Vanity Fair about the Columbine anniversary, and our executive producer, Stephen Valentino, said, sometimes I wonder if this is when we slipped into the alternative timeline, that the inability to take action after Columbine, the idea things were frozen in place, that this is just the way America was going to be, that seemed to infect many areas of public life after. And Stephen's point was maybe Columbine was the first very visible symptom that something was going very wrong, that either our politics was very broken or our culture was very broken. Do you buy that?
Yeah, I totally do. You know, it was not the first mass shooting, but it definitely started the mass shooter era. It's comparable kind of to like the Vietnam War and Watergate in the ways it sort of changed cultural attitudes, the way we actually live.
But it didn't change the gun debate in a meaningful way.
Oh, yeah. But I was going to say, you know, Vietnam and Watergate together are famous for having destroyed America's faith in institutions. And I think Columbine was another version of that. Some of the lines of what you're saying, that there's this massive problem of gun deaths in America. And it, you know, quote, proved that we couldn't solve it and that we just had to give up, that we were powerless to solve our things. And I think it, again, destroyed faith, you know, that Congress or, you know, our government was going to do anything. And it was really then it was 3 things over 12 years. You know, Columbine, we thought everything was going to change. It didn't. But then, you know, there was a building being, well, the next big one. So when Virginia Tech happened, I believe 8 years later, 2007, then there was a feeling, OK, both of them together. Now it's really going to happen. And there were a lot of big attempts and there was, like, you know, huge faith that it would. That fails. We got more pessimistic. And then Sandy Hook was the last straw, I believe 2011.
2012. And everybody said after Sandy Hook, if a room full of elementary school students are slaughtered and nothing changes, nothing's ever going to change. I totally agree with you on that framing that it's Columbine, it's Virginia Tech, where 32 people died, and then Sandy Hook. But, you know, to roll it back to Columbine and say, isn't there a timeline where there could have been action, where this could have inspired stricter laws? This could have made caused change. There is a timeline where something very different would have come out of Columbine and yet didn't.
Totally. And what's interesting is that in other areas, it did. So law enforcement changed drastically. You know, then, believe it or not, the protocol was like surround the building and, you know, wait for the demands of people taking the hostages. So they surrounded the school and didn't go in for nearly an hour. So that changed drastically. LAPD got really launched this and created the active shooter protocol. And they worked with the Columbine Sheriff's Department and changed how law enforcement did this. And now, you know, these things usually get neutralized within, you know, 5 to 10 minutes. And they did it within schools themselves, you know, created lockdown drills. The word didn't exist before that. You know, students wearing IDs, all kinds of things changed. Now, how much those helped is debatable, but they changed things. So there were those. I hate the word mental health because we can talk about later. It needs to be narrowed way down, but we did nothing there. Nothing with teen depression and with gun laws. So that's sort of the fourth big one. Nothing. Yeah, so, I mean, the first two proved that we could do something very easily and did. And in these other arenas, well, it's impossible.
You mentioned mental health. You said it needs to be narrowed. What do you mean by that?
Well, we are not going to change or fix the mental health industry based on this. It's never going to happen. But we don't need to, you know, start narrowing that to doable things. The vast majority are deeply depressed, usually suicidally depressed. So this is depression is much smaller than mental health. We won't get them all, but we'll get, you know, the vast majority. That's still big. But we already know how to treat teen depression. All we have to do is screen for it to identify them. There is a screening device, PHQ-9. You can Google it. It's widespread use. There are several of them. It takes about 1 minute to fill out. Every high school in America should pass that out in a homeroom twice a year. And then, you know, the kids, then if they reach a certain score, also you can score in like 30 seconds. If they reach a certain score, they go on for, you know, to a counselor and then, you know, get treatment. So they could be doing that. And not only would that stop most of the school shooters in their school, so they will bring the likelihood of their school being hit, you know, way down closer to zero. The bigger effects, it will drastically reduce drug and alcohol dependence in their school, teen pregnancy, even car crashes. You will solve so many much bigger things. And in the process, most of the school shooters will disappear. That is the easiest thing. You know, I talk about depression as the great unlearned lesson of Columbine, because I'm always asked, like, what lessons have we learned? Well, there's one massive one that we didn't learn. We can do that today.
Very interesting. Dave, I have one more question for you. I'll get to it after a quick break. All right, stick around. We'll be right back with Dave Cullen.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, we hope you've been enjoying our show. And if you have, please leave us a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Don't forget to hit the follow button also, so you never miss an episode. I'm Brian Stelter, speaking with Dave Cullen, author of the book Columbine. And Dave, you write in the updated preface to your book that you've tried to leave this story so many times. It's been 25 years, so why haven't you?
You know, I keep coming back because it keeps happening. And God, there's a horrible diagram that I made and the publisher helped with, opening the prelude of like all these other shootings directly depended on Columbine. And I literally picture that diagram when these happen, and I have nightmares about that. It looks sort of a spider web of all these mass shootings coming out of Columbine. And I have nightmares about like a spider doing these webs, and I can't leave while it's, until we do something.
It's incredible to hear all the connections you have, Dave, all of the lessons you've learned over these years, over these decades. What do you feel like you've learned about humanity, about the human condition by studying mass murders, mass shooters, but also the victims and their families?
Well, I don't want to be Pollyannish, but kids bounce back pretty well and adults don't. Broad brush. So the day after Columbine, I expected totally the opposite. So the day of Columbine, I was out there within an hour and I was like one of the first reporters there, and just the whole scene, the kids, like everyone was crying. It's exactly what you can imagine, right? And people like hugging each other. You know, I wrote in the book about like, there was so much squeezing. If you look at the pictures from that day, everybody's squeezing. There's this iconic picture in Time magazine of this girl squeezing her head. Everyone was sort of like holding on to each other. Total emotional, what you expect. The next morning was the opposite. And I just got goosebumps because it still gives me the chills. All the kids, like 2,000 of them in the Clement Park, had blank affect, is what psychologists call it. Like they looked like zombies, like just wiped out, Stepford kids. And they could all tell me when it happened, like 3 o'clock, 3 a.m., 4, none of them had slept, like 4 a.m. And then it happened like a switch going off. That they were incredibly emotional and it stopped. You know, when I talked to the trauma people, like, you know, that's PTSD. The brain just like, okay, overload, can't take anymore, and goes numb. That was the scariest thing in the world. Oh my God. And, you know, teenagers, you're on them, you know, there's always this boisterous noise, energy, which is great. And then like, when it doesn't, like they've all been lobotomized. Oh my God. So I was afraid this would be like the lost generation, you know, after, you know, World War I. And they might never get over it. They did. And I didn't worry so much about the parents and the adults. It was true like that. And if you sort of like graph the sort of like trauma, the kids gradually got better. Within 2 to 3 years, most of them were doing a lot better. But by the 5-year anniversary, most of them were kind of, not all, were, you know, finding their way back. And God, the parents, especially of the victims, you know, I wrote in the afterword a year out that Linda Mauser, the mother of Daniel Mauser, who was killed, you know, she talked to me about like going to pieces in her dental hygienist's chair, like 10 years out. And, you know, the dental hygienist said like, oh, did it happen recently? And she said, Linda said, when your kid dies, it's always recently. So, yeah, the kids in general resilient, and so many of the adults weren't.
You're reminding us that 25 years on, this is still a present day, present tense story, a present day tragedy. There are people who are suffering today, 25 years later.
You know, I witnessed something that media never gets to, because 19 years on the 19th anniversary of Columbine, they had a bunch of Parkland students come meet with Columbine survivors, and they brought in people from 8 or 10 different mass shootings who happened to live in the Denver area. And they had this private thing. Everyone had to leave the school, even teachers and kids. And the principal, Mr. D, stuck me in the back. He said, you know, you're one of us now, you can. And so I witnessed something extraordinary. One of the Columbine teachers who just retired, and she was an English teacher there. She taught Rachel Scott, the first victim, and Dylan Klebold. She said she loved them both, but Well, she and some of the other Columbine teachers go to these other schools and help them. She went to Sandy Hook right after. She went to Parkland and many of the others. And they told this story at Sandy Hook a couple of days after. She was there, you know, with all the teachers. And one of the teachers said, I just want to know, when am I going to get my life back? And this Columbine teacher, I'm forgetting her name, is she's extraordinary, empathetic. And she said, you're never getting her back. And you're not going to even start your healing until you accept that. That woman who walked into school that day, she's never coming back. You're going to be a completely different person. And the first big hurdle for all of us getting through that is letting go of the person who walked into that school that day and accepting that you're this other person now. And that's for life. And so when you think about all these people who have gone through those, they're a different person now. And thousands and tens of thousands of kids and teachers and parents changed forever. So on a very personal level, you know, that's what this does.
Dave, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
And once again, that was journalist Dave Cullen, who's been covering mass murders for over two decades. We're also joined today by Vanity Fair's Dan Adler. This episode of Inside the Hive was produced by Gianna Palmer. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. We had engineering assistance from James Yost and mixing by Bob Mallory. We'll be back in your podcast feed next week.
America has a problem, one that is uniquely ours. On the new season of Long Shadow, I delve into the complicated history of firearms from the Second Amendment to the AR-15. I try to make sense of how we got here and how we might find a path forward. From Longlead, PRX, and Campside Media, in collaboration with The Trace, I'm Garrett Graff, and this is Long Shadow, In Guns We Trust. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.